steam. Madame Manic says, "The frog cooks." Orders. Werner is summoned by an 11-year-old in full regalia to the commandant's office. He waits on a wooden bench in a slowly building panic. They must suspect something. Maybe they discovered some fact about his parentage that even he doesn't know. Something ruinous. He remembers when the Lance Corporal came through the door of Children's House to escort him to Herr Siedler's. The certainty that the instruments of the Reich could see through walls, through skin, into the very soul of each subject. After several hours, the commandant's assistant calls him in and sets down his ballpoint and looks across his desk as though Werner is one among a vast series of trivial problems he must put right. "It has come to our attention, cadet, that your age has been recorded incorrectly." "Sir?" "You are 18 years old, not 16, as you have claimed." Werner puzzles. The absurdity is plain. He remains smaller than most of the 14-year-olds. "Our former technical sciences professor, Dr. Hauptmann, has called our attention to the discrepancy. He has arranged that you will be sent to a special technology division of the Wehrmacht."
"A division, sir?"
"You have been here under false pretenses." His voice is oily and pleased. His chin is non-existent. Out a window, the school band practices a triumphal march. Werner watches a Nordic-looking boy stagger beneath the weight of a tuba. "The commandant urged disciplinary action, but Dr. Hauptmann suggested you would be eager to offer your skills to the Reich." From behind his desk, the assistant produces a folded uniform. Slate gray, eagle on the breast, Litzen on the collar. Then a green-black coal scuttle helmet, obviously too large. The band blares, then stops. The band instructor screams names. The commandant's assistant says, "You are very lucky, cadet. To serve is an honor."
"When, sir?"
"You'll receive instructions within a fortnight. That is all." Pneumonia. Breton spring, and a great onslaught of damp invades the coast. Fog on the sea, fog in the streets, fog in the mind. Madame Manic gets sick. When Marie-Laure holds her hand over Madame's chest, heat seems to steam up out of her sternum, as though she cooks from the inside. Her breathing devolves into trains of oceanic coughs.
"I watch the sardines," murmurs Madame, "and the termites, and the crows."
Etienne summons a doctor who prescribes rest, aspirin, and aromatic violet comfrey. Marie-Laure sits with Madame through the worst of it, strange hours when the old woman's hands go very cold and she talks about being in charge of the world. She is in charge of everything, but no one knows. It is a tremendous burden, she says, to be responsible for every little thing. Every infant born, every leaf falling from every tree, every wave that breaks onto the beach, every ant on its journey. Deep in Madame's voice, Marie-Laure hears water. Atolls and archipelagos and lagoons and fjords. Etienne proves to be a tender nurse. Washcloths, broth, now and then a page from Pasteur or Rousseau. His manner forgiving her all transgressions past and present. He wraps Madame in quilts, but eventually she shivers so deeply, so profoundly, that he takes the big heavy rag rug off the floor and lays it on top of her. Dearest Marie-Laure, your parcels arrived. Two of them, dated months apart. Joy is not a strong enough word. They let me keep the toothbrush and comb, though not the paper they were wrapped in, nor the soap. How I wish they would let us have soap. They said our next reposting would be to a chocolate factory, but it was cardboard.
All day we manufacture cardboard. What do they do with so much? All my life, Marie-Laure, I have been the one carrying the keys. Now I hear them jangling in the mornings when they come for us. And every time I reach in my own pocket, only to find it empty. When I dream I am in the museum. Remember your birthdays? How there were always two things on the table when you woke? I'm sorry it turned out like this. If you ever wish to understand, look inside Etienne's house. Inside the house. I know you will do the right thing, though I wish the gift were better. My angel is leaving, so if I can get this to you, I will. I do not worry about you because I know you are very smart and keeping yourself safe. I am safe too, so you should not worry. Thank Etienne for reading this to you. Thank in your heart the brave soul who carries this letter away from me and on its way to you. Your papa. Treatments. Von Rumpel's doctor says that fascinating research is being done on mustard gases, that the anti-tumor properties of any number of chemicals are being explored. The prognosis is looking up. In test subjects, lymphoid tumors have been seen to reduce in size, but the injections make Von Rumpel dizzy and weak. In the days following, he can hardly manage to comb his hair or convince his fingers to button his coat. His mind plays tricks, too. He walks into a room and forgets why he's there. He stares at a superior and forgets what the man just said. The sounds of passing cars are like the tines of forks dragged along his nerves. Tonight he wraps himself in hotel blankets and orders soup, and unwraps a bundle from Vienna. The mousy brown librarian has sent copies of the Tavernier and the Streeter and even, most remarkably, stencil duplicates of Debut's 1604 Gemarum et Lapidum Historia, written entirely in Latin. Everything she could find concerning the Sea of Flames. 9 paragraphs total. It takes all his concentration to bring the text into focus. A goddess of the earth who fell in love with a god of the sea. A prince who recovered from catastrophic injuries, who ruled within a blur of light. Von Rumpel closes his eyes and sees a flame-haired goddess charge through the tunnels of the earth, drops of flame glowing in her wake. He hears a priest with no tongue say, "The keeper of the stone will live forever." He hears his father say, "See obstacles as opportunities, Reinhold. See obstacles as inspirations." Heaven. For a few weeks, Madame Manic gets better. She promises Etienne she will remember her age, not try to be everything to everyone, not fight the war by herself. One day in early June, almost exactly 2 years after the invasion of France, she and Marie-Laure walk through a field of Queen Anne's lace east of Saint-Malo. Madame Manic told Etienne that they were going to see if strawberries were still available at the Saint-Servan market. But Marie-Laure is certain that when they stopped to greet a woman on the way here, Madame dropped off one envelope and picked up another. At Madame's suggestion, they lie down in the weeds and Marie-Laure listens to honeybees mine the flowers and tries to imagine their journeys as Etienne described them, each worker following a rivulet of odor, looking for ultraviolet patterns in the flowers, filling baskets on her hind legs with pollen grains, then navigating, drunk and heavy, all the way home. How do they know what parts to play, these little bees? Madame Manic takes off her shoes and lights a cigarette and lets out a contented groan. Insects drone. Wasps, hoverflies, a passing dragonfly. Etienne has taught Marie-Laure to distinguish each by its sound. What's a Ronio machine, Madame? Something to help make pamphlets. What does it have to do with that woman we met? Nothing to trouble yourself over, dear. Horses nicker, and the wind comes off the sea, gentle and cool and full of smells. Madame, what do I look like? You have many thousands of freckles. Papa used to say they were like stars in heaven, like apples in a tree. They are little brown dots, child. Thousands of little brown dots. That sounds ugly. On you, they are beautiful. Do you think, madame, that in heaven we will really get to see God face to face?
We might.
What if you're blind?
I'd expect that if God wants us to see something, we'll see it.
Uncle Etienne says heaven is like a blanket babies cling to. He says people have flown airplanes 10 kilometers above the earth and found no kingdoms there, no gates, no angels.
Madame Manic cracks off a ragged chain of coughs that sends tremors of fear through Marie-Laure.
You are thinking of your father, she finally says. You have to believe your father will return.
Don't you ever get tired of believing, madame? Don't you ever want proof?
Madame Manic rests a hand on Marie-Laure's forehead, the thick hand that first reminded her of a gardener's or a geologist's.
You must never stop believing. That's the most important thing.
The Queen Anne's lace sways on its taproots, and the bees do their steady work.
If only life were like a Jules Verne novel, thinks Marie-Laure, and you could page ahead when you most needed to, and learn what would happen.
Madame?
Yes, Marie.
What do you think they eat in heaven?
I'm not so sure they need to eat in heaven.
Not eat?
You would not like that, would you? But Madame Manic does not laugh the way Marie-Laure expects her to. She doesn't say anything at all. Her breath clatters in and out.
Did I offend you, madame?
No, child.
Are we in danger?
No more than any other day.
The grasses toss and shimmy. The horses nicker. Madame Manic says, almost whispering,
Now that I think about it, child, I expect heaven is a lot like this.
Frederick. Werner spends the last of his money on train fare. The afternoon is bright enough, but Berlin seems not to want to accept the sunlight, as though its buildings have become gloomier and dirtier and more splotchy in the months since he last visited. Though perhaps what has changed are the eyes that see it. Rather than ring the bell right away, Werner laps the block 3 times. The apartment windows are uniformly dark, whether unlit or blacked out he cannot tell. At certain points on each circuit he passes a storefront filled with undressed mannequins, and though he knows each time that it is merely a trick of the light, he cannot stop his eyes from seeing them as corpses strung up by wires. Finally, he rings the bell for number 2. No one buzzes down, and he notices from the nameplates that they are no longer in number 2. Their name is on number 5. He rings. A returning buzz issues from inside. The lift is out of order, so he walks up. The door opens. Franny, with a downy face and swinging flaps of skin under her arms. She gives him a look that one trapped person gives another. Then Frederick's mother swishes out of a side room wearing tennis clothes.
Why, Werner!
She loses herself momentarily in troubled reverie, surrounded by sleek furniture, some of it wrapped in thick wool blankets.
Does she blame him? Does she think he is partially responsible?
Perhaps he is.
But then she comes awake and kisses him on both cheeks, and her bottom lip quivers lightly, as if his materialization is preventing her from keeping certain shadows at bay.
He won't know you. Don't try to make him remember, it will only upset him. But you were here. I suppose that's something.
I was about to go. Very sorry I cannot stay.
Show him in, Franny.
The maid leads him into a grand drawing room, its ceilings a swirl with plaster flourishes, its walls painted a delicate eggshell blue. No paintings have been hung yet, and the shelves wait empty and cardboard boxes stand open on the floor.
Frederick sits at a glass-topped table at the back of the room, both table and boy looking small amid the clutter. His hair has been combed hard to one side, and his loose cotton shirt has bunched up behind his shoulders so that his collar is skewed. His eyes do not rise to meet his visitors. He wears the same old black-framed glasses. Someone has been feeding him, and the spoon rests on the glass table, and blobs of porridge cling to Frederick's whiskers and his placemat, which is a woolen thing featuring happy pink-cheeked children in clogs. Werner cannot look at it. Franny bends and pushes three more spoonfuls into Frederick's mouth and wipes his chin, folds up his placemat, and walks through a swinging door into what must be a kitchen. Werner stands with his hands crossed in front of his belt. 1 year. More than that. Frederick has to shave now, Werner realizes. Or someone has to shave him. Hello, Frederick. Frederick rolls his head back and looks toward Werner through his smudged lenses down the line of his nose. I'm Werner. Your mother said you might not remember. I'm your friend from school. Frederick seems not so much to be looking at Werner as through him. On the table is a stack of paper, on top of which a thick and clumsy spiral has been drawn by a heavy hand. Did you make this? Werner lifts the topmost drawing. Beneath that page is another, then another. 30 or 40 spirals, each taking up a whole sheet, all in the same severe lead. Frederick drops his chin to his chest, possibly a nod. Werner glances around. A trunk, a box of linens, the pale blue of the walls, and the rich white of the wainscot. Late sunlight glides through tall French windows, and the air tastes of silver polish. This fifth-floor apartment is indeed nicer than the second-floor one. The ceiling's high and decorated with punched tin and stucco flourishes. Fruits, flowers, banana leaves. Frederick's lip is curled and his upper teeth show, and a string of drool swings from his chin and touches the paper. Werner, unable to bear it a second longer, calls for the maid. Franny peeks out of the swinging door. Where, he asks, is that book? The one with the birds in the gold slipcover? I don't think we ever had a book like that. No, you did. Franny only shakes her head and laces her fingers across her apron. Werner lifts the flaps of boxes, peering in. Surely it's around here. Frederick has begun to draw a new spiral on a blank sheet. Maybe in this? Franny stands beside Werner and plucks his wrist off the crate he is about to open. I do not think, she repeats, we ever had a book like that. Werner's whole body has started to itch. Out the huge windows, the lindens toss back and forth. The light fades. An unlit sign atop a building 2 blocks away reads, Berlin smokes Junos. Franny has already retreated back into the kitchen. Werner watches Frederick create another crude spiral, the pencil locked in his fist. I'm leaving Schopforte, Frederick. They're changing my age and sending me to the front. Frederick lifts the pencil, studying, then reapplies it. Less than a week. Frederick works his mouth as if to chew air. You look pretty, he says. He does not look directly at Werner, and his words are close to moans. You look pretty. Very pretty, mama. I'm not your mama, hisses Werner. Come on now. Frederick's expression is entirely without artifice. Somewhere in the kitchen, the maid is listening. There is no other sound, not of traffic, or airplanes, or trains, or radios, or even the specter of Frau Schwarzenberger rattling the cages of the elevator. No chanting, no singing, no silk banners, no bands, no trumpets, no mother, no father, no slick-fingered commandant dragging a finger across his back. The city seems utterly still, as though everyone is listening, waiting for someone to slip. Werner looks at the blue of the walls and thinks of birds of America. Yellow-crowned heron, Kentucky warbler, scarlet tanager, bird after glorious bird, and Frederick's gaze remains stuck in some terrible middle ground, each eye a stagnant pool into which Werner cannot bear to look.
Relapse. In late June 1942, for the first time since her fever, Madame Manic is not in the kitchen when Marie-Laure wakes. Could she already be at the market? Marie-Laure taps on her door, waits 100 heartbeats. She opens the rear door and calls into the alley. Glorious, warm June dawn, pigeons and cats, screech of laughter from a neighboring window. Madame? Her heart accelerates. She taps again on Madame Manic's door. Madame? When she lets herself in, she hears the rattle first, as though a weary tide stirs stones in the old woman's lungs. Sour odors of sweat and urine rise from the bed. Her hand finds Madame's face, and the old woman's cheek is so hot that Marie-Laure's fingers recoil as though scalded. She scrambles upstairs, stumbling, shouting, "Uncle! Uncle!" The whole house turning scarlet in her mind, roof turning to smoke, flames chewing through walls. Etienne crouches on his popping knees beside Madame, then scurries to the telephone and speaks a few words. He returns to Madame Manic's bedside at a trot. Over the next hour, the kitchen fills with women. Madame Ruel, Madame Fontenot, Madame Ebrard. The first floor becomes too crowded. Marie-Laure paces the staircase, up and down, as though working her way up and down the spire of an enormous seashell. The doctor comes and goes. The occasional woman closes her bony hand around Marie-Laure's shoulder, and at exactly 2 o'clock, by the bonging of the cathedral bells, the doctor returns with a man who says nothing beyond "good afternoon," who smells of dirt and clover, who lifts Madame Manic and carries her out into the street, and sets her on a horse cart as though she is a bag of milled oats, and the horse's shoes clop away, and the doctor strips the bedsheets, and Marie-Laure finds Etienne in the corner of the kitchen, whispering, "Madame is dead. Madame is dead." Chapter 6. 8 August 1944. Someone in the house. A presence. An inhalation. Marie-Laure trains all of her senses on the entryway 3 flights below. The outer gate sighs shut, then the front door closes. In her head, her father reasons, "The gate closed before the door, not after. Which means, whoever he is, he closed the gate first, then shut the door. He's inside." All the hairs on the back of her neck stand up. "Etienne knows he would have triggered the bell, Marie. Etienne would be calling for you already." Boots in the foyer, fragments of dishes crunching underfoot. It is not Etienne. The distress is so acute it is almost unbearable. She tries to settle her mind, tries to focus on an image of a candle flame burning at the center of her ribcage, a snail drawn up into the coils of its shell, but her heart bangs in her chest and pulses of fear cycle up her spine, and she is suddenly uncertain whether a sighted person in the foyer can look up the curves of the stairwell and see all the way to the 3rd floor. She remembers her great-uncle said that they would need to watch out for looters. And the air stirs with phantom blurs and rustles, and Marie-Laure imagines charging past the bathroom into the cobwebbed sewing room here on the 3rd floor, and hurling herself out the window. Boots in the hall. The slide of a dish across the floor as it is kicked. A fireman? A neighbor? Some German soldier hunting food? "A rescuer would be calling for survivors, ma chérie. You have to move. You have to hide."
The footfalls travel toward Madame Manic's room. They go slowly. Maybe it's dark. Could it already be night? 4 or 5 or 6 or 1,000,000 heartbeats roll by. She has her cane, Etienne's coat, the 2 cans, the knife, the brick, model house in her dress pocket, the stone inside that, water in the tub at the end of the hall. Move. Go. A pot or pan, presumably knocked off its hook in the bombing, wobbles on the kitchen tiles. He exits the kitchen, returns to the foyer. Stand, ma chérie. Stand up now. She stands. With her right hand, she finds the railing. He is at the base of the stairs. She almost cries out, but then she recognizes, just as he sets his foot on the first stair, that his stride is out of rhythm. 1, pause, 2. 1, pause, 2. It is a walk she has heard before, the limp of a German sergeant major with a dead voice. Go. Marie-Laure takes each step as deliberately as she can, grateful now that she does not have her shoes. Her heart knocks so furiously against the cage of her chest that she feels certain the man below will hear it. Up to the 4th floor, each step a whisper, the 5th. On the 6th floor landing, she pauses beneath the chandelier and tries to listen. She hears the German climb 3 or 4 more stairs and take a brief asthmatic pause, then on again. A wooden step complains beneath his weight. It sounds to her like a small animal being crushed. He stops on what she believes is the 3rd floor landing, where she was just sitting, her warmth still there on the wood floor beside the telephone table, her dissipated breath. Where does she have left to run? Hide. To her left waits her grandfather's old room. To her right waits her little bedroom, the window glass blown out. Straight ahead is the toilet, still the faint reek of smoke everywhere. His footfalls cross the landing. 1, pause, 2. 1, pause, 2. Wheezing. Climbing again. If he touches me, she thinks, I will tear out his eyes. She opens the door to her grandfather's bedroom and stops. Below her, the man pauses again. Has he heard her? Is he climbing more quietly? Out in the world waits a multitude of sanctuaries, gardens full of bright green wind, kingdoms of hedges, deep pools of forest shade through which butterflies float, thinking only of nectar. She can get to none of them. She finds the huge wardrobe at the far end of Henri's room, and opens the 2 mirrored doors and parts the old shirts hanging inside, and slides open the false door Etienne has built into its back. She squeezes into the tiny space where the ladder rises to the garret. Then she reaches back through the wardrobe, finds its doors, and closes them. Protect me now, Stone, if you are a protector. Silently, says the voice of her father. Make no noise. With one hand she finds the handle Etienne has rigged onto the false panel on the back of the wardrobe. She glides it shut, 1 centimeter at a time, until she hears it click into place, then takes a breath, and holds it for as long as she can. The Death of Walter Berndt. For an hour Berndt murmured gibberish. Then he went silent, and Folkheimer said, God have mercy on your servant. But now Berndt sits up and calls for light. They feed him the last of the water in the 1st canteen. A single thread of it runs down through his whiskers, and Werner watches it go. Berndt sits in the glimmer of the field light and looks from Folkheimer to Werner. On leave last year, he says, I visited my father. He was old all my life, but now he seemed especially old. It took him forever just to cross his kitchen. He had a package of cookies, little almond cookies. He put them out on a plate, just the package lying crosswise,
Neither of us ate any. He said, "You don't have to stay. I'd like you to stay, but you don't have to. You probably have things to do. You can go off with your friends if you want to." He kept saying that. Volkheimer switches off the light, and Werner apprehends something excruciating held at bay there in the darkness.
"I left," says Bernd. "I went down the stairs and into the street. I had nowhere to go, nobody to see. I didn't have any friends in that town. I'd ridden the trains all goddamn day to see him. But I left, just like that."
Then he is quiet. Volkheimer repositions him on the floor with Werner's blankets over him, and not long afterward, Bernd dies. Werner works on the radio. Maybe he does it for Jutta, as Volkheimer suggested, or maybe he does it so he does not have to think about Volkheimer carrying Bernd into a corner and piling bricks onto his hands, his chest, his face. Werner holds the field light in his mouth and gathers what he can. A small hammer, 3 jars of screws, 18-gauge line cord from a shattered desk lamp. Inside a warped cabinet drawer, miraculously, he discovers a zinc-carbon 11-volt battery with a black cat printed on the side. An American battery, its slogan offering 9 lives. Werner spotlights it in the flickering orange glow, amazed. He checks its terminals. Still plenty of charge. When the field light battery dies, he thinks, "We'll have this." He rights the capsized table, sets the crushed transceiver on top. Werner does not yet believe there is much promise in it, but maybe it is enough to give the mind something to do, a problem to solve. He adjusts Volkheimer's light in his teeth, tries not to think about hunger or thirst, the stoppered void in his left ear, Bernd in the corner, the Austrians upstairs, Frederick, Frau Elena, Jutta, any of it. Antenna. Tuner. Capacitor. His mind, while he works, is almost quiet. Almost calm. This is an act of memory.
Sixth-floor bedroom. Von Rumpel limps through the rooms with their faded white moldings and ancient kerosene lamps, and embroidered curtains and Belle Epoque mirrors, and ships in glass bottles and push-button electrical switches, all dead. Faint twilight angles through smoke, and shutter slats in hazy red stripes. Temple to the Second Empire, this house. A bathtub 3/4 full of cold water on the 3rd floor. Deeply cluttered rooms on the 4th. No dollhouses yet. He climbs to the 5th floor, sweating, worrying he got everything wrong. The weight in his gut swings pendulously. Here's a large, ornate room crammed with trinkets and crates and books and mechanical parts. A desk, a bed, 3 windows on each side. No model. To the 6th floor. On the left, a bedroom with a single window and long curtains. A boy's cap hangs on the wall. At the back looms a massive wardrobe, mothballed shirts hung inside. Back to the landing. Here's a little water closet, the toilet full of urine. Beyond it, a final bedroom. Seashells are lined along every available surface. Shells on the sills and on the dresser, and jars full of pebbles lined up on the floor, all arranged by some indiscernible system. And here. Here. Here on the floor, at the foot of the bed, sits what he has been searching for. A wooden model of the city, nestled like a gift. As big as a dining table, brimming with tiny houses. Except for flakes of plaster in its streets, the little city is entirely undamaged. The simulacrum now more whole than the original, a work of clear magnificence. In the daughter's room. For her. Of course. Von Rumpel feels as if he has come triumphantly to the end of a long journey, and as he sits on the edge of the bed, twin flares of pain riding up from his groin, he has the curious sensation of having been here before, of having lived in a room like this, slept in a lumpy bed like this,
collected polished stones and arrayed them like this, as though somehow this whole set has been waiting for his return. He thinks of his own daughters, how much they would love to see a city on a table. His youngest would want him to kneel beside her. "Let's imagine all the people having their supper," she'd say. "Let's imagine us, Papa." Outside the broken window, outside the latched shutters, Saint-Malo is so quiet that Von Rumpel can hear the rustle of his own heartbeat shifting hairs in his inner ear. Smoke blowing over the roof, ash falling lightly. Any moment the guns will start again. Gently now. It will be in here somewhere. It is just like the locksmith to repeat himself. The model. It will be inside the model. Making the radio. One end of wire Werner crimps around a shorn pipe standing diagonally up from the floor. With spit, he wipes clean the length of the wire and coils it 100 times around the base of the pipe, making a new tuning coil. The other end he slings through a bent strut wedged into the congestion of timber, stone, and plaster that has become their ceiling. Folkheimer watches from the shadows. A mortar shell explodes somewhere in the city and a flurry of dust sifts down. The diode goes between free ends of the two wires and meets the leads of the battery to complete the circuit. Werner runs the beam of Folkheimer's light over the entire operation, ground, antenna, battery. Finally, he braces the flashlight between his teeth and raises the twin leads of the earphone in front of his eyes, and strips them against the threads of a screw, and touches the naked ends to the diode. Invisibly, electrons bumble down the wires. The hotel above them, what is left of it, makes a series of unearthly groans. Timber splinters, as though the rubble teeters on some final fulcrum, as though a single dragonfly could alight on it and trigger an avalanche that will bury them for good. Werner presses the butt of the earphone into his right ear. It does not work. He turns over the dented radio case, peers into it, wraps Folkheimer's fading light back to life. Settle the mind. Envision the distribution of current. He rechecks the fuses, valves, plug pins. He toggles the receive, send switch. Blows dust off the meter selector. Replaces the leads to the battery. Tries the earphone again. And there it is, as if he is 8 years old again, crouched beside his sister on the floor of Children's House. Static. Rich and steady. In his memory, Jutta says his name, and on its tail comes a second, less expected image. Twin ropes strung from the front of Herr Siedler's house, the great smooth crimson banner hanging from them, unsoiled, deeply red. Werner scans frequencies by feel. No squelch, no snap of Morse code, no voices. Static, 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 static. In his functioning ear. In the radio. In the air. Folkheimer's eyes stay on him. Dust floats through the feeble beam of the flashlight, 10,000 particles turning softly, twinkling. In the attic. The German shuts the wardrobe doors and hobbles away, and Marie-Laure stays on the bottom rung of the ladder for a count of 40. 60. 100. The heart scrambling to deliver oxygenated blood, the mind scrambling to unravel the situation. A sentence Etienne once read aloud returns. Even the heart, which in higher animals, when agitated, pulses with increased energy, in the snail, under similar excitement, throbs with a slower motion. Slow the heart. Flex your feet. Make no sound. She presses her ear to the false panel on the back of the wardrobe. What does she hear? Moths gnawing away at her grandfather's ancient smocks? Nothing. Slowly, impossibly, Marie-Laure finds herself growing sleepy. She feels for the cans in her pockets. How to open one now,
without making noise. Only thing to do is climb. 7 rungs up into the long triangular tunnel of the garret. The raw timbered ceiling rises on both sides toward the peak, just higher than the top of her head. Heat has lodged itself up here. No window, no exit. Nowhere else to run. No way out except the way she has come. Her outstretched fingers find an old shaving bowl, an umbrella stand, and a crate full of who knows what. The attic floorboards beneath her feet are as wide across as her hands. She knows from experience how much noise a person walking on them makes. Don't knock anything over. If the German opens the wardrobe again and yanks aside the hanging clothes and squeezes through the door and climbs up into the attic, what will she do? Knock him on the head with the umbrella stand? Jab him with the paring knife? Scream. Die. Papa. She crawls along the center beam from which the narrow planks of floor emanate, toward the stone bulk of the chimney at the far end. The center beam is thickest and will be quieter. She hopes she has not become disoriented. She hopes he is not behind her, leveling a pistol at her back. Bats cry almost inaudibly out the attic vent, and somewhere far away, on a naval ship perhaps, or way out past Parame, a heavy gun fires. Crack. Pause. Crack. Pause. Then the long scream as the shell comes flying in, the thump as it explodes on an outer island. A ghastly creeping terror rises from a place beyond thoughts. Some innermost trap door she must leap upon immediately and lean against with all her weight and padlock shut. She takes off the coat and spreads it across the floor. She dares not pull herself up for fear of the noise her knees will make on the boards. Time passes. Nothing from downstairs. Could he have gone? So quickly. Of course he is not gone. She knows, after all, why he is here. To her left, several electric cords wind along the floor. Just ahead is Etienne's box of old records. His wind-up Victrola. His old recording machine. The lever he uses to hoist the aerial alongside the chimney. She hugs her knees to her chest and tries to breathe through her skin, soundlessly like a snail. She has the two cans, the brick, the knife. Chapter 7. August 1942. Prisoners. A dangerously underweight corporal in threadbare fatigues comes for Werner on foot. Long fingers, a thatch of thinning hair beneath his cap. One of his boots has lost its lace, and its tongue lolls cannibalistically. He says, "You're little." Werner, in his new field tunic and oversized helmet, and regulation Gott mit uns belt buckle, draws his shoulders back. The man squints at the huge school in the dawn, then bends and unzips Werner's duffel and rifles through the 3 carefully folded NPEA uniforms. He raises a pair of trousers against the light and seems disappointed that they are not remotely his size. After he closes the bag, he throws it over his shoulder. Whether to keep or merely carry it, Werner cannot guess. "I'm Neumann. They call me Two. There's another Neumann, the driver. He's One. Then there's the engineer and the sergeant, and you, so, for whatever it's worth, that's 5 again." No trumpets, no ceremony. This is Werner's induction into the Wehrmacht. They walk the 3 miles from the school to the village. In a delicatessen, black flies swim over a half dozen tables. Neumann, too, orders 2 plates of calf's liver, and eats both, using dark little bread rolls to sop up the blood. His lips shine. Werner waits for explanations, where they're going, what sort of unit he'll be joining, but none are forthcoming. The color of the arms displayed under the corporal's shoulder straps and collar tabs is wine red, but Werner can't remember what that is supposed to signify. Armored infantry? Chemical warfare? The old Frau collects the plates.
Neumann, too, removes a small tin from his coat, dumps 3 round pills on the table, and gulps them down. Then he puts the tin back inside his coat and looks at Werner.
Backache pills.
You have money? Werner shakes his head. From a pocket, Neumann, too, pulls some crumpled and filthy Reichsmarks. Before they leave, he asks the Frau to bring 12 hard-boiled eggs and hands Werner 4. From Schulpforte, they ride a train through Leipzig and disembark at a switching station west of Łódź. Soldiers from an infantry battalion lie along the platform, all of them sleep, as though some enchantress has cast a spell over them. Their faded uniforms look spectral in the dimness, and their breathing seems synchronized, and the effect is ghostly and unnerving. Now and then, a loudspeaker mutters destinations Werner has never heard of. Grimma, Wurzen, Grossenhain. Though no trains come or go, and the men do not stir. Neumann, too, sits with his legs spread and eats eggs one after another, piling the shells into a tower inside his upturned cap. Dusk falls, a soft, tidal snoring issues from the sleeping company. Werner feels as though he and Neumann, too, are the only souls awake in the world. Well after dark, a whistling sounds in the east, and the drowsing soldiers stir. Werner comes out of a half-dream and sits up. Neumann, too, is already upright beside him, palms cupped against each other as though attempting to hold a sphere of darkness in the bowl of his hands. Couplings rattle. Brake blocks grind against wheels. And a train emerges from the gloom, moving fast. First comes a blacked-out locomotive, bolted over with armor, exhaling a thick geyser of smoke and steam. Behind the locomotive rumble a few closed cars, and then a machine gun in a blister, 2 gunners crouching beside it. All of the cars following the gunner's car are flat cars loaded with people. Some stand, more kneel. 2 cars pass, 3, 4. Each car appears to have a wall of sacks along the front to serve as windbreak. The rails below the platform shine dully as they bounce beneath the weight. 9 flat cars, 10, 11, all full. The sacks, as they pass, seem strange. They look as though they have been sculpted out of gray clay. Neumann, too, raises his chin.
Prisoners.
Werner tries to pick out individuals as the cars blur past. A sunken cheek, a shoulder, a glittering eye. Are they wearing uniforms? Many sit with their backs against the sacks at the front of the car. They look like scarecrows, shipping west to be staked in some terrible garden. Some of the prisoners, Werner sees, are sleeping. A face flashes past, pale and waxy, one ear pressed to the floor of the car. Werner blinks. Those are not sacks. That is not sleep. Each car has a wall of corpses stacked in the front. Once it becomes clear that the train will not stop, all the soldiers around them settle and close their eyes once more. Neumann, too, yawns. Car after car, the prisoners come, a river of human beings pouring out of the night. 16, 17, 18. Why count? Hundreds and hundreds of men, thousands. Eventually, from the darkness rushes a final flat car where again the living recline on the dead, followed by the shadow of another gun in a blister, and 4 or 5 gunners, and then the train is gone. The sound of the axles fades, silence seals itself back over the forest. Somewhere in that direction is Schulpforte with its dark spires, its bedwetters and sleepwalkers and bullies. Somewhere beyond that the groaning leviathan that is Solverein. The rattling windows of Children's House. Jutta. Werner says, they were sitting on their dead? Neumann, too, closes an eye and cocks his head like a rifleman aiming into the darkness where the train has receded.
Bang, he says. Bang, bang.
The wardrobe. In the days following the death of Madame Manic, Etienne does not come out of his study. Marie-Laure imagines him hunched on the davenport, mumbling children's rhymes and watching ghosts shuttle through the walls. Behind the door, his silence is so complete that she worries he has managed to depart the world altogether.
Uncle? Etienne?
Madame Blanchard walks Marie-Laure to the church for Madame Manick's memorial. Madame Fontenot cooks enough potato soup to last a week. Madame Guibou brings jam. Madame Ruel somehow has baked a crumb cake. Hours wear out and fall away. Marie-Laure sets a full plate outside Etienne's door at night and collects an empty plate in the morning. She stands alone in Madame Manick's room and smells peppermint, candle wax, 6 decades of loyalty. Housemaid, nurse, mother, confederate, counselor, chef. What 10,000 things was Madame Manick to Etienne? To them all. German sailors sing a drunken song in the street, and a house spider over the stove spins a new web every night, and to Marie-Laure this is a double cruelty, that everything else keeps living, that the spinning earth does not pause for even an instant in its trip around the sun.
Poor child.
Poor Monsieur LeBlanc.
Like they're cursed.
If only her father would come through the kitchen door, smile at the ladies, set his palms on Marie-Laure's cheeks. 5 minutes with him. 1 minute. After 4 days, Etienne comes out of his room. The stairs creak as he descends, and the women in the kitchen fall silent. In a grave voice, he asks everyone to please leave.
I needed time to say goodbye. And now I must look after myself and my niece.
Thank you. As soon as the kitchen door has closed, he turns the deadbolts and takes Marie-Laure's hands.
All the lights are off now. Very good.
Please, stand over here. Chairs slide away. The kitchen table slides away. She can hear him fumbling at the ring in the center of the floor. The trap door comes up. He goes down into the cellar.
Uncle? What do you need?
This, he calls.
What is it?
An electric saw.
She can feel something bright kindle in her abdomen. Etienne starts up the stairs, Marie-Laure trailing behind. Second floor, third floor, fourth, fifth, sixth. Left turn into her grandfather's room. He opens the doors of the gigantic wardrobe, lifts out his brother's old clothes, and places them on the bed. He runs an extension cord out onto the landing and plugs it in. He says,
"It will be loud."
She says, "Good." Etienne climbs into the back of the wardrobe and the saw yowls to life. The sound permeates the walls, the floor, Marie-Laure's chest. She wonders how many neighbors hear it, if somewhere a German at his breakfast has cocked his head to listen. Etienne removes a rectangle from the back of the wardrobe, then cuts through the attic door behind it. He shuts down the saw and wriggles through the raw hole, up the ladder behind it, and into the garret. She follows. All morning, Etienne crawls along the attic floor with cables and pliers and tools her fingers do not understand, weaving himself into the center of what she imagines as an intricate electronic net. He murmurs to himself, fetches thick booklets or electrical components from various rooms on the lower stories. The attic creaks. Houseflies draw electric blue loops in the air. Late in the evening, Marie-Laure descends the ladder and falls asleep in her grandfather's bed to the sound of her great-uncle working above her. When she wakes, barn swallows are churring beneath the eaves and music is raining down through the ceiling. Clair de Lune, a song that makes her think of leaves fluttering and of the hard ribbons of sand beneath her feet at low tide. The music slinks and rises and settles back to earth, and then the young voice of her long-dead grandfather speaks. There are 96,000 kilometers of blood vessels in the human body, children. Almost enough to wind around the earth 2.5 times. Etienne comes down the 7 ladder rungs and squeezes through the back of the wardrobe, and takes her hands in his. Before he speaks, she knows what he will say.
Your father asked me to keep you safe.
I know.
This will be dangerous. It is not a game.
I want to do it.
Madame would want...
Tell it to me. Tell me the whole routine.
22 paces down the Rue Vauberel to the Rue d'Estrée. Then right for 16 storm drains. Left on the Rue Robert-Surcouf. 9 more storm drains to the bakery. I will go to the counter and say, 1 ordinary loaf, please.
How will she reply?
She will be surprised, but I am supposed to say, 1 ordinary loaf. And she is supposed to say, How is your uncle?
She will ask about me?
She is supposed to. That's how she will know that you are willing to help. It's what Madame suggested. Part of the protocol.
And you will say...
I will say, My uncle is well, thank you, and I will take the loaf and put it in my knapsack and come home.
This will happen even now, without Madame.
Why wouldn't it?
How will you pay?
A ration ticket.
Do we have any of those?
In the drawer downstairs. And you have money, don't you?
Yes, we have some money.
How will you come back home?
Straight back.
By which route?
9 storm drains down the Rue Robert-Surcouf, right on the Rue d'Estrée, 16 drains back to the Rue Vauberel.
I know it all, Uncle. I have it memorized. I've been to the bakery 300 times.
You mustn't go anywhere else. You mustn't go to the beaches.
I'll come directly back.
You promise?
I promise.
Then go, Marie-Laure. Go like the wind.
East. They ride in boxcars through Łódź, Warsaw, Brest. For miles out the open door, Werner sees no sign of humans save the occasional rail car capsized beside the tracks, twisted and scarred by some kind of explosion. Soldiers clamber on and off, lean, pale, each carrying a pack, rifle, and steel helmet. They sleep despite noise, despite cold, despite hunger, as though desperate to stay removed from the waking world for as long as possible. Rows of pines divide endless metal-colored plains. The day is sunless. Neumann, too, wakes and urinates out the door and takes the pillbox from his coat and swallows 2 or 3 more tablets.
Russia, he says, though how he has marked the transition, Werner cannot guess.
The air smells of steel. At dusk, the train stops and Neumann, too, leads Werner on foot through rows of ruined houses, beams and bricks lying in charred heaps. What walls stand are lined with the black cross hatchings of machine gun fire. It's nearly dark when Werner is delivered to a muscle-bound captain dining alone on a sofa that consists of a wooden frame and springs. In a tin bowl, in the captain's lap, steams a cylinder of boiled gray meat. He studies Werner a while without saying anything, wearing a look not of disappointment but tired amusement.
Not making them any bigger, are they?
No, sir.
How old are you?
18, sir.
The captain laughs.
12, more like it.
He slices off a circle of meat and chews a long time and finally reaches into his mouth with 2 fingers and flings away a string of gristle.
You'll want to acquaint yourself with the equipment. See if you can do better than the last one they sent.
Neumann, too, leads Werner to the open back of an unwashed Opel Blitz, a cross-country 3-ton truck with a wooden shell built onto the back. Dented gasoline cans are strapped to one flank. Bullet trails have left wandering perforations down the other. The leaden dusk drains away.
Neumann, too, brings Werner a kerosene lantern.
Gadgets are inside.
Then he vanishes. No explanations.
Welcome to war.